You ready for an Ask Dan question?
I'm ready.
Okay. Thank you, listener, for writing in. They say, Dan, I am financially stable, but money still causes me a lot of anxiety. Is there a number that will bring me security or peace of mind?
The answer is no.
I knew you were going to say no. I should have just written back and said, no, there's no number. No. Tell us why.
There's no number. Having done thousands of financial plans, there are people that just will not believe that they can spend what I say they can spend. And that if I do say that, they'll spend less or they'll spend more. There is no number. It has to be complemented by a balanced life. If your only focus is on the number, that's not healthy. It's really not healthy. And the number having to last 10, 20, 70 years, whatever it is, here's an example. You get a job. You love your job, but the job doesn't pay a lot. I focus on the fact that you like the job. Some of my wealthiest clients do not make a lot of money, but they're so happy with what they're doing. You know, they can piece together a few bucks a month to go into their 401k or to reduce debt or whatever their goals are, knowing that, hey, you know, the majority of my day, I'm going to be working at something I really love to do. And to me, that's a total win.
Yeah. So mental health and finances, super intertwined.
Super intertwined. There was a time in my life when I was a father, a husband, and we had just had our third child. And I wanted desperately for my wife, Susan, to be able to, you know, spend a good year and a half to 2 years with my youngest, our new baby, Benjamin.
Right, because she was a working mom. She was a physical therapist.
Yeah. You and Janine were
five and eight
years old at the time. So the best thing for my family at that time was for my wife to be at home.
And she wanted that.
That was the goal. Losing her income at that juncture of our life would have hurt, but I was motivated to plug that gap. In preparation for that, I became a basketball referee. I built up a very heavy schedule, so I was able to do that. Then I also got a part-time job from 3:30 a.m. to 5:30 a.m. daily, being a adult paper route.
Delivery man.
Delivery man. I did that for 2 years.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. And the only thing I sacrificed during that 2 year period was sleep. And to me, I would never have traded that for anything in the world. This is before I got into the brokerage industry. When you want something, you have to create a path.
So this is good because I think a lot of times mental health can come as like a, well, yeah, it would be nice if I could think about my mental health, but I have so much going on. So yeah. At the time, how did you stay grounded?
I always stay grounded because I just saw the joy that Sue and I had knowing that our family was connected. I think at that point in our lives, the five of us, we created a bond that could never be replaced. As evidenced by some recent home movies we watched together.
Yeah.
You'll see that I was present, a little sleepy, but I was present.
Oh, big time, big time. Yeah. I think we should share one of those videos with this episode. I think that would be good. There's some really nice dancing that happens.
Well, this episode of Dan Has a Plan will cover a lot of areas.
We're going to get to some more questions so that we can really capitalize on this and get people some answers. So we're going to start with this one. I'm in my late 40s and feel like I'm behind on retirement savings. How much should I be contributing to catch up? And is it too late to make up for lost time? Kristen, any thoughts? Well,
I'd start off with it's never too late.
Definitely never too late.
Never too late. 40s is still young.
Yeah.
Well, it still is. You still have time. I think really it comes down to also when you plan on retiring, how many years you have in you until you want to retire. And then I think the plan kind of helps us figure out how much you need to save to get to where you want to be.
And clients have to understand you don't microwave wealth.
Go on.
So for this particular circumstance, you know, Chris and I would meet with this person and get the baseline of their plan and what her ability to save is. Mm-hmm. And then overlay that with a risk tolerance to show you what kind of ride she would have to the goal she's trying to reach. So case in point, a normal portfolio that pounds at 7%, the money doubles in 10 years.
Oh, great.
You can get 10% compounded return. However, if you're going to get 10% compounded return, you're going to take on more risk. Your money will double in 7 years. We show them the risk and reward in the plan based on the risk tolerance. But to Kristen's point, the most important thing is this plan is going out into their mid 90s. For this person who is in her late 40s, you know, that's 55 plus years. There's plenty of time.
Last questions for Kristen.
Yeah, maybe share with us an aha moment for you where you went home that day and just felt really good.
I would say an aha moment for me was actually, it built up over a period of time, but we had a client who was in her late 80s, early 90s, speaking earlier about what we said about end of life planning and stuff. her husband passed away, had a lot of different accounts in different places that she didn't even know about. She lived about an hour away. I'd go up there probably once a month and talk to her often too, but just to sort of get her on the same page because there were things everywhere. And she really appreciated it. And I really found she was a wonderful woman. So it was nice to spend time with her. She enjoyed it. I felt like I was helping her. So I would say that was the moment where I was kind of like, you know, you really are helping people. And that I think is a really special part of the business.
Wow. You make such an impact.
He sure does.
All right. Well, this listener asks, and we're going to get into all of this, but here's the background. First of all, he's a fan of the show. Hi, Dan. Love the show.
Wow. Got a fan out there.
And we love you. He writes, I'm 55, married, and two kids in high school, and two sets of recently retired grandparents. Meaning, I think he means his parents and his partner's parents. I've managed our finances on my own up to this point, but I'm starting to feel the squeeze from all sides. I've never worked with a financial planner like yourself. I feel pretty good about retirement, but it seems like your approach is pretty holistic. So what kinds of things would you help with beyond just picking investments or beyond the balance sheet, if you will? He says, I'm thinking about college, aging parents, insurance, taxes, all of it. What could I expect in, say, our first year working together? But I really think that this is about, he's 55, he's got kids who are about to go off to college, he's got parents who seem well, recently retired, and, you know, might need some support going forward. So this is a classic sandwich generation listener.
Yes. How I'd like to attack the answer to this question is, let's start with step one. Step one is communication.
Okay.
So to specifically answer this question by this listener, and thank you for listening, I would attack it in the following manner. I would emphasize that we should do a financial plan first. And that's more for empowerment. Mm-hmm. He or she makes the statement that I think I'm in pretty good shape for retirement planning. Okay. But let's validate that first.
Yeah. Is there more you could be doing?
Yes. Secondly, let's expand the rubber band a little bit. He mentioned kids. So that's multiple to me that are near college age. Mm-hmm. Okay. I always offer to meet with the kids.
Oh, great.
So I can report back to them. What's their lens? What lens are they looking through? Okay. Have they selected a college? Do they have any clue about how that's going to be paid for? Have they looked at in-state versus out-of-state? You know, there's just a myriad of things.
Yeah, we have a whole episode about college admissions.
Right. The second piece to that is doing a financial plan for the kids. They can do their own financial plan because the decision they're going to make about college is really going to greatly.
How do I recover from holiday overspending?
That's a common financial planning thing that happens when I meet with clients in January and February.
Yeah. So it's not really a question of how do I budget for the holidays? Maybe that's next year's question, but how do they stop freaking out?
So when you incur credit card debt that cannot be paid off in full when you receive the account statement, then other things have to go in abeyance. For example, I'm a true believer of this. If you're contributing monthly to a Roth IRA, a traditional IRA, or your 401k, people do that religiously monthly. I'm not a believer in investing unless you're debt-free. I'm talking about no credit card debt, no student loans. Those are the two main pieces of debt I talk to people about. There's always going to be a transportation expense, and there's always going to be a housing expense, mortgage, etc. So let's take it in bite-sized pieces. Let's say you have $10,000 in credit card debt and you're contributing $1,000 a month to your 401k. I'd rather you stop contributing to your 401k and attack the debt. And usually with doing it at $1,000 a month for that $10,000 bill, that can be retired in 6 months. And then you can re-engage with adding to your retirement plans. You know, it's a difficult discussion. People are happy coming off the holidays, but they're unhappy with their debt.
Well, quick question. If, say, you have someone who isn't contributing regularly, how would you attack that debt without taking from that other pot?
Well, if they're not contributing to 401k plans or IRAs or Roth IRAs yet, that means that, you know, the steps are simple. You have to have a certain amount of cash that you can rely upon for your monthly expenses. And then it's a matter of examining your budget as to where the money's going. So if you have, like I said, $5,000, $10,000 in credit card debt, I usually sit down with the client. We go over their budget. And we see where we can commit to an amount monthly, taking from maybe a discretionary area of their budget. Could be dining out, it could be entertainment, like going to concerts, something like that. so that they can be out of debt when the warm weather comes, especially in the Northeast. They can enjoy the outside activities they like, and they can prioritize their budget for the rest of the year. Because what you don't want to have is that you have debt in January, and then the holidays come up again at the end of the year, and you have more debt, so that compounds things.
So you got to move it to the top of the priority.
You got to move it to the top. And then along with that, once the debt is retired, if holiday spending is important to you and is meaningful to you, come up with a number. Then you have to save for it.
Yeah.
Those are the cold, hard facts. And, you know, my personal experience with the holidays is this. If you're gifting to someone, obviously you have a relationship with them, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Okay. First and foremost, they know intuitively that you care for them. And I know that people are generous for the holidays. Grandmas and grandpas are very generous with grandchildren, as an example.
Of course.
And the joke is always they play more with the boxes of the presents they open than they do with the toys themselves.
Right.
Okay. So I would just say that the cost of the gift is not a representation of how much you love someone. For example, if you spend $100 on something and give it to the person as opposed to $1,000, it doesn't mean you love them any less.
Yeah, okay? Good reminder.
I don't mean to be the Grinch here, but...
You're not. I think you're the opposite of the Grinch.
And the other thing is there's gifts that cost nothing. You know, one of my favorite gifts that I receive or give is spending time with someone. Just a simple example. I have 3 children. If I could take a walk with them or a hike with them for an hour and we just talk, that is a gift to me. I love that type of gift.
I love it too. That's a great reminder. Obviously, this person is scared of their credit card statement already. So we just want to send some love and say, start with the plan and you'll get through it.
Correct. There's always a way to attack problems. And I always tell clients, I look out the front window. All right. I'm not looking in the rearview mirror.
Yeah.
The front window of the car is where we're going. How do we get there? You know, spending time on how we got to where we are, it's debilitating to the conversation.
Yeah. It makes people feel bad. There's shame. We talk about that all the time.
Yes.
But there's like all these emotions tied up and you're saying, just look forward.
I always tell clients, listen, if your budget is $10,000 and you spend $5,000 on lollipops, if it brings you joy and it's in your budget, and you're not sacrificing your long-term goals.
Bring on the lollipops.
Bring on the lollipops.
All right, good. The question today, ask Dan. Today's question is, Dan, can you explain the difference between a certified financial planner, CFP, and regular financial advisor? And why is it worth the extra effort to find a CFP?
That's a great question. And I get that question a lot. And mostly the question I get is, are you a certified financial planner?
And
I can say yes. When I first started out in my career, I was not. And after a few years, I got that accreditation. So the accreditation part is important. The second thing is certified financial planner. And that's what I believe in. I believe in planning. Doing a financial plan by a CFP, they look through a lens of not how we're going to get paid, but more about what is right for the client. So it could be a non-financial goal. So let's just say you're meeting with a prospect and the prospect has $5 million in assets. I don't look at the $5 million. I look at what's surrounding it. Do they have a will and estate plan? Are they working with a certified public accountant? Do they have life insurance? Do they have long-term care insurance? Is the account titling correct? Whereas I think a lot of advisors want to rush to how they're going to get paid, putting the money in motion so they're able to financially benefit from that portfolio.
I see.
So I lead into it very simply. I look at the total picture first. The investments are the vehicle to fulfill the financial plan. And I explain to the clients maybe 3 or 4 options, and I let them go down the path of what they're most comfortable with. I will, of course, give my recommendation, which I think is in their best interest. But at the end of the day, the client has to feel comfortable with their plan, because at the end of the day, it's their plan. It's not my plan. It's not UBS's plan. It's their plan.
Yes, their hard-earned money.
Correct.
And it's their retirement, which is...
Well, it's everything.
Yeah.
It's everything. So
finding that right person for you and making sure that they have the highest accreditation to deal with your most personal piece of your life.
Listen, there's other accreditations in our industry, and I'm not belittling any of those. For me personally, this is what I connect with. This is what I believe in, and I've been doing it since 2002. So that's a long period of time. I haven't seen a better method of handling the client experience. So I get a lot of questions on trusts. And
first of all, what is a trust?
That's my first question.
Okay. You are the co-host. So you get to ask questions.
I'm speaking for the people.
A trust is a document that provides the following. I always say protection first. A trust protects people against in-laws, outlaws, creditors, and predators. Okay. That cover it all?
No. So it's an account.
Yeah. So let's boil it down to your question specifically. You are Alana J. Smith.
That's me.
You have an account in your personal name. You are a sole practitioner.
Heyo.
So if you are sued, let's say you get in a car accident, they can sue you personally, and those assets are exposed because they're in your personal name.
Right.
Let's say we put the assets via an attorney into a revocable trust. That would protect you, meaning that now you have a legal document. It's the Alana J. Smith Revocable Trust. From a tax perspective, it's even Steven. However, it would give you a level of protection against this car accident. But the second thing is if you get married, that's not a marital asset.
Ah, I see.
Okay, so it protects you against, you know, if you have a divorce, it's your money. Thirdly, because we have to take the worst case scenario.
Sure.
You pass away, the revocable trust has a beneficiary. That means that in the state of New Jersey, you do not have to go through a process called probate. You don't have to go to Hackensack, New Jersey and get a letter of testamentary from the will that you probably didn't prepare. And if you didn't prepare a will, then your siblings as next of kin would have to go down there and get appointed as the next of kin of your estate. And it's a public document.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you have a revocable trust, it passes by way of beneficiary. It is not a public document. So your information is not public. It goes to your sister and brother.
So where does this come into play with a sandwich generation person?
For a sandwich generation person, just thinking out loud, okay, but with their parents, there's two sets of parents, okay, not knowing anything about their financial well-being, okay, they may consult with an attorney to protect assets from very high health care costs down the line, meaning that your home could be put into a trust, your monies can be put into a trust. There's something called an irrevocable trust, so you can get it out of your estate. I'm getting a little deeper here, but there's things that can be done and explored if you're looking to protect assets from very high health care costs.
So yeah, case by case basis, this might come into play.
Yeah.
All right. So this listener writes in, and I thought it would be, it's perfect for our guest today. She says, "Hi, Dan. I'm a mom of a Division III volleyball player at Muhlenberg. My daughter's majoring in psychology, and playing on the team has been such a lifeline for her. It's given her confidence, community, and joy. But there's no scholarship money, and the costs are real. Tuition, travel, equipment, it all adds up. She's talking about taking out loans and picking up a part-time job just to stay afloat. We both know she's not going pro. This sport isn't her future, but it's such a big part of her right now. I just want to do right by her to support what she loves without setting her up for financial stress after graduation. How do parents like me walk that line between being present for the moment and protecting their financial future?"
Wow.
It's a great question.
That is a great question.
It's a concerned mom question.
It is. How I would attack this question if I were sitting face to face with this woman, I think you have to start with hopes and dreams. I'm a big believer, and this is kind of counterintuitive to traditional financial planning advice. You want to make sure that your child is pursuing something that brings them joy. And certainly volleyball seems to be the center of this question. And it brings her camaraderie. It brings her a sense of community. It brings her self-satisfaction. The difference between a Division I and a Division III athlete is rather cavernous. There is no, future of making a living being a volleyball player, by and large. I'm sure there's exceptions.
Yeah, but I think people going into D3 know that, right?
They do. And, I know Muhlenberg is a private college. I know approximately what the costs are. And what I would say is just having a heart-to-heart with your daughter. And I've been involved in many of these conversations where you just have to lay out the dollars and cents versus quashing a dream.
And also she's asking about should her daughter take on loans and or a part-time job? I know you were a D3 athlete.
I was.
And you had part-time jobs.
Yeah, I worked in the summer. I worked during the school year. I also had loans when I came out of college. What you have to do, and this wasn't you know, my circumstance, because none of those things were discussed. But I want to answer this question of this woman. The counterbalance that is, if you take out loans, obviously it's going to meet the financial obligation to pay the school. If you counterbalance that with working on campus, it subsidizes what you would have to take out in loans. But the post-college experience might be something like, well, instead of getting a job and moving out and getting your own apartment, et cetera, might be living at home for a couple of years. Are you willing to pay that price? Okay. So that's where, you know, really the transition of financial planning goes from the parent to the daughter. That's really when she should start doing her financial plan. So there's definitely a path to getting this type of equation done, but it really comes down to meeting with someone that can guide them through this emotional decision.
Right. And having open and honest conversations about it all. I think what I'm hearing in the question is just a lot of worry and fear. And I think what you're saying is the plan, as usual, takes care of the worry and fear.
Yeah. And I think my sense is that these open discussions aren't being had with the daughter, and that can turn into a real emotional experience. So meeting with a planner to discuss the parameters of that decision, so both the mom and the daughter are fully aware going in, eyes wide open. And then post-college, the daughter transitioning to her financial plan and whatever the indebtedness is, to attack that first before getting on the path of saving and, you know, securing her financial future.
Right. So I think what we're saying is don't quit volleyball. We can figure it out.
Yeah. I would never advise, you know, not pursuing a passion.
Yeah.
As long as it's a healthy passion.
All right. Well, talking about healthy passions, I think we got to get Bruce on here to weigh in his 2 cents on D3 athletics and hear some tales from the mat.
The Bruce Haberle.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Incorporated offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Incorporated is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.